Sumter is invited to go back to a breeding so that our collective energy of mindfulness will bring us together as an organism, going as a river with no more separation. Let the whole Sangha breathe as one body, generate peace as one body, be free as one body. Let us transcend the boundaries of the delusive self, liberating from the superiority complex, the inferiority complex, and the equality complex.
This is the second day of our four-day retreat here at the Franciscan Center on the teachings of insight, Vipassana, the way of higher seeing. There are a couple of things, but one thing, I'm looking in our, as far as any mindfulness, our chanting service. And this morning we chanted the Heart Sutra. The Bodhisattva Avalokita, while moving in the deep course of perfect understanding, shed light on the five skandhas and found this equally empty. After this penetration, he overcame ill-being. That's called Vipassana. So you're in good company. All Buddhas, all Bodhisattvas, all Masters have liberated themselves through Vipassana. They have done exactly what we're doing. Whether you do it the way we're doing it, kind of in a formal way, or whether you do it just in a very spontaneous, natural way, it is only through seeing into the true nature of reality that one can be liberated from one's false views, one's attachment, aversion, and all the emotional afflictions that arise from that. So the Bodhisattva Avalokita, while moving in the deep course of perfect understanding, shed light on the five skandhas and found them equally empty. Everybody here can do the same. The course of your understanding may not be as deep as a lot as far as we don't know. But everyone here has the capacity of shining light on their five skandhas. When you shine light on something, it can be seen clearly, right? When there's no light, it's in darkness. So what we're doing in our Vipassana, we are looking with a flashlight, right? A strong light into the very aggregate of our body and mind to see what's really there. And after this penetration, he overcame ill-being. Ill-being is a word they've translated as suffering, dukkha. I don't think there's anybody here who doesn't want to overcome their suffering. This is the way to do it. As we said earlier, while there are many technologies, practices, teachings within the Buddhist tradition that help remediate suffering, calming the mind, pacifying the mind, quieting the mind, loving kindness meditation, compassion meditation, you know, many different teachings that are very helpful. But none of them get at the root of the problem. Right? The root of the problem is ignorance. From ignorance comes delusive thoughts. From delusive thoughts come afflictive emotions. Right? The deep practice is one that goes to the root. Right? If I didn't like that tree anymore, right? If I just cut off the upper branches in the short run, that may give me a better view. But they will grow back. They will grow back. And once again, I'll have to be up there in the tree. Trimming. And that's where most people practice. We're constantly trimming. We're constantly pruning. I mean, again, there's nothing wrong with that. But if you're, you know, I have to say if you're lazy, but that's not really the case. You know, but if you kind of go, there's got to be something more than constantly trimming and pruning. You go back, next day, trimming, pruning, you know. Again, there's always trimming and pruning. From my understanding, up until full enlightenment, there's always some degree of trimming and pruning. But it's much easier to trim or prune something small than something large. That's a lot of work. And many of us, our daily, weekly, monthly trimming and pruning is often big stuff. Right? Big dramas. Big emotional upset. Big sufferings. And not just, you know, a few snips in here and there. And it gets everything right again. Life. Shovels and axes kind of things. So if we want to uproot the sources of our suffering at a deeper level, we have to get to the root. We can't be satisfied with always pruning back the outer branches. Even some of the inner branches. Right? We might even cut into the trunk, and still it may grow back again. So we have to uproot it, and the only way to uproot it is through vipassana. All Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, it says, you know, we said in the incense offering, may we and all beings be companions of Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. What a beautiful phrase. Well, companions means what? I mean, it could mean friends. No, but I think usually we use the word companions like companions on a journey. May we be companions of Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. If you want to be a companion of a Buddha and Bodhisattvas, you have to what? Join them in their journey. And their journey is only a path of understanding and compassion. That's the journey of the Buddha and the Bodhisattva. And it's a journey, again, that has to be walked. You know, when we recited the names, when we did Touching the Earth to the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, again, there was no Bodhisattva called Great Reading Bodhisattva. Great purchaser of Dharma videos, Bodhisattva. Why was that? Because none of them attain realization in that way. If you could attain realization that way, then they'd be a great Bodhisattva of reading. same way that Bodhisattvas, you know, for their great compassion, their great understanding, their great action, their great capacity to benefit sentient beings, the Bodhisattva is known for their great libraries. You know, and they read the most books of anyone. I think the wonderful, the fresh air of Thich Nhat Hanh in his, there are many things, but in his engaged Buddhism, which postulated that Buddhism has to be engaged in the real lives of people. That's where the transformation has to take place. We can study the Heart Sutra, we can study the 16 types of emptiness, we can debate this stuff back and forward. But if we're still always angry at our loved ones, if we still are struggling with anger, if we still are struggling with fear, if we are still maintaining a narcissistic attitude to life. So what with all our study and reading? Emptiness must be something to realize and to practice. It has implications as we are learning through our work here in the meditation hall during this retreat. You know, when we bow to these bodhisattvas, when we touch the earth, as we recall them, we are touching in every way the potential each of us has. Enlightened aspect of our true mind. Shakyamuni Buddha, teaching and living the way of awareness in the very midst of suffering and confusion. That tells us something, right? Teaching and living the way of awareness in the midst of suffering and confusion. We want to teach and live the way of awareness in very beautiful surroundings, better peaceful. Right. Everybody is supportive and loving. But the Buddha teaches and lives the way of awareness in the very midst of life. Right? Doesn't retreat. It's active in the... trouble hearing? Okay, is that better? Is this thing on? Yeah. What? Is that better? Should I put it on, kind of attach to my lip or something? What do you do with it? Is that better? Is that better? I don't know, maybe I just talked louder. Teaching and living the way of awareness in the very midst of suffering and confusion, Shakyamuni. Cutting through ignorance, awakening our hearts and minds, Manjusri. So again, these are instructions. These are instructions. They're telling us how to live. Right? Live the way of awareness in the midst of suffering and confusion. Cut through your ignorance. Awake your heart and mind. Work mindfully, joyfully for the sake of well-being. Respond to suffering, serve beings in countless ways. This is the way to worship the Bodhisattvas. Well, it is certainly good to make offerings to them, if that is your bent. This is the real offering. They are not deities outside our own experience. They are exemplars of enlightened life. Who leads enlightened life? Sentient beings with enlightened lives. Right? seed of awakening and loving kindness in children, spouse, and all beings. Each of us has the seed of awakening, the seed of loving kindness. We fall asleep and we wake up. Throughout the day, we have the potential continually to wake ourselves up, to come home, to remind ourselves of what's true. That's what our practice is. So please be aware that when we do the touching the earth, we are touching deeply our own nature, our own enlightened nature, and how it manifests in life. All these things we chant, they're all teachings. We shouldn't just chant them as words. But we should chant them as practices, reminders of how to practice. The five remembrances, essential. So this is basic Dharma. We love the high stuff. We love non-duality and emptiness, right? But this is it too. You know, you can meditate on impermanence, but meditate on your own impermanence, on your own aging, on your own sickness, on your own death, and the death of everyone you love. All that is dear to me and everyone I love are of the nature of change. There is no way to escape being separated from them. If you really meditate on the five remembrances, you will no longer be thrown by the changes in the world. Right? If you're still going, I can't believe that happened, or I can't believe this happened, or we have not meditated on the five remembrances. We should never be surprised by anybody's death. Everyone that we know is going to die. And the time is unknown. Because why? Because we are of the nature to die. And that's just the truth. That's just the fact. And if we are going to be a benefit to sentient beings, to be protectors of them, to be guides of them, to be supports for them, we have to understand this deeply, because there are many people who don't understand this, right? Who are afraid, who are in denial. So if we want to help them, we have to get clear within ourselves. Many people in our society, without going into all the reasons, have great difficulty with growing old these days, much less dying. It's almost like for many people, they'd rather die than get old. Well, can't I just be young and youthful and then die? Right? But I don't have to go through that kind of getting sick and old stuff. Right? There may be people in this room who are struggling that way. Please, every day, I am of the nature to grow old. Maybe we should say these things, each of you should, we should all say it, looking at ourselves in the mirror. Look at yourself in the mirror. And look at the person you see and say to them, we are of the nature to get old. We are of the nature to get sick. And we are going to die. One day we will not be looking in the mirror. And not only that, but everyone I love, everyone is dear to me, is subject to the same thing, to sickness, old age, and death. That's just the truth. There is no way to escape being separated from that. You know, in our own selfishness, we often say, what? Let me go first. But then they're going to have to deal with our loss. I mean, it's kind of... But that's the way we are. We're always trying to, you know, gain the system in our favor. I inherit the results of my actions in body, speech, and mind. This is, you know, no matter how much I've read, no matter how much I've discussed, no matter how, you know, my karma is propelled by the actions of my body, speech, and mind. So we need to be more and more impeccable in our actions, the actions of our body, the words of our speech, and in our thoughts. That is propelling us on the wheel. We can need fight, you know. Please don't just see this, you know, chanting service as like a chanting book. Something we stop our sitting, we have a little break, and we chant and sing a little bit. These are profound teachings that have the power to liberate us. Right in this little book. You don't have to read another book. Right? Go home, burn all your books. You know, here you have the full path of Dharma, especially since you have the Heart Sutra and verses on the face line of the third picture. I mean, this is it. Right? And we won't even charge you for this. But, you know, the mind, we're always looking, you know, endless books, especially these days, right? It's just books after books after books in Buddhism, all saying the same thing in various, you know, all variations on a theme. How many times do we have to read it before we get it? Right? I remember my first teacher, Philip Kaplow, used to say about reading. He said, you know, when people would ask him about reading, he said, you know, again, you know, in Zen, especially that kind of Zen, you know, everything is about, you know, on the cushion, on the mat. He'd say, you know, if your reading motivates you to get on the mat, then it's good reading. If your reading inspires you to practice and you practice, then it's good reading. But if you're reading, if you're done reading, you know, you go get some ice cream, you know, what's it doing for you? You know, we think we're making progress because we're reading more and thinking more. We cannot think ourselves out of our predicament. Again, if we could, there would be listed here a bodhisattva of great reading. But there isn't. And again, you know, you come to my house, you'll see many books. But we have to understand clearly that we may enjoy reading Dharma books, we may love to read Dharma books, but that will not free us, that will not liberate us. So only the work that we're doing on the cushion, only the work we're doing in the reality of our daily life will liberate us. That's where liberation is. In the very midst of suffering and confusion, Shakyamuni courageously practices the way of awareness. There's nowhere else to practice. Right? If we practice our practice courageously here, you know, it's a piece of cake. I mean, I know there are people struggling here. But you know what I'm saying? It's in our lives. That's where the courage is. When the other people in your life and your own reactive formations and habit forces are pushing you in another way, right? The way you've always reacted or responded. It takes courage to stop. Right? It takes courage to stop and do it differently. There's a great saying in the Kadampa tradition, you know, give victory to others. Right? Give victory to others. Let them be right. Right? Let them win this one. We're bodhisattvas. We're here to make people happy. If they're happy winning arguments and thinking they're right, let them have it. What do we care? You know, we're not here to win arguments, are we? We're not here to be better than anyone. We're not here to show anybody anything. We're here to awaken ourselves. Right? And if we are going to encounter people around issues, let us be helpful. Right? Let us be wise. Let us come from a place of compassion to end suffering. So again, great book of teachings. You don't need anything more than this. This is even too much. But, before we return, I do want to return to our text today. There's a long note and she talks about after the teachings yesterday and some of the dialogues that went on, she disembodied her husband. I think she means deconstructed. Disembodied is an interesting word, but it sounds like, you know, entailed and anyhow. So anyhow, please, for those of you who are working on, you know, loved ones, please, I did not say disembody them. Please deconstruct them in your own mind. Okay? After she disembodied her husband again, without romanticizing him, she did this several times, and the second time she found it somewhat disturbing and sorrowful. Since I see how much I view him and his body parts with rose-colored glasses, I rested, but I was tired and disquieted. But then I woke with an insight. If my romantic view of my husband is a story, a construct, then my view of everything is a construct. And if, as you often point out, there is no me, just some odd conglomerate of cause and condition from others which is constantly in flux, then all the stories are being made up by a very unreliable source. I think we have here what is called insight. That is not coming from reading other people's insights, but getting your own insights. Made up by a very unreliable source. This includes, I might add, the stories about my Dharma teacher, of course. All our projections are made up. So what does that leave me? My direct experience and an awareness that my ideas are far less serious than I had imagined. My question for you is, how do I continue to cultivate these seeds other than by repeatedly disembodying my spouse? I just wanted to share that with you, but you know, we will be continuing today and the next few days talking about how we continue the practice. So, the wheel of investigation and meditation that thoroughly purifies mental activity, by Jamyang Nipam Rinpoche. Again, as you know, there are the three marks of existence, and then in the Mahayana, the four seals, but they're basically more or less the same. These are the major insights that to really be a practitioner of Buddha Dharma one must cultivate, and that is insight into impermanence, insight into suffering, insight into composite nature of all things, and that everything is devoid of self, especially human beings. That's where we say that to practice Buddha Dharma is really to go counter to, you know, normal way of seeing, right? Because we know that the normal way that people look at life is they see permanence. Therefore, when impermanence occurs, they're either scared or saddened or angry or at least in disbelief, right? Because they have a deluded notion that things are supposed to be stable and permanent. Right? Buddhists should not see things in that way. So we should not be surprised by anything, right? Because we know that anything that occurs is caused by something. Right? There must have been causes and conditions that created whatever occurred, even the most horrible things, such as wars and violence. It seems like we kind of understand, but even the things that happen, you know, school shootings and these other kinds of killings that have gone on recently. Recently, there were two policemen in St. Petersburg that were killed. It's not denying the sadness of that, but we should not be surprised, right? I mean, when you have in a society anger, hatred, fear, when you have ignorance, when you have drugs and alcohol, when you have people spending so much of their lives in prison, you know what I mean? When you have guns that are so available, you know, and when you have violence being so common and violence and use of guns just ubiquitous throughout the media, you know, how can these things not occur? Right? They will occur. I mean, if you have a dry forest and you have people, with campfires, how can you not at some point have what? A forest fire, right? Causes and conditions. This is not to put a judgment, good, bad. It's just to say we should not be surprised by any of this. Causes and conditions. Things are always changing. Everything is always impermanent. Things do not stay the same because causes and conditions are always being activated. You know, one of the reasons that there is such instability is because nothing is solid. Everything is made up of composite parts. Every human being is made up of composite parts. Many different types of thoughts, many different types of feelings, many different types of experiences are present in each and every one of us human beings. Right? Because of that, and because there is no glue to hold any of it together, right? It also is because of emptiness, really, that impermanence occurs, that change occurs. So the second insight is into that things are not solid, but things are all made of parts. They are empty of anything solid and permanently existent. The third thing, as we said, is that in each and everything, suffering and the potential for suffering is always present. There's always that potential. Right? We had a delicious dinner last night, and some people were complaining stomach problems, too much gas. It was so delicious. Other people might have really enjoyed the meal and then felt heavy and bloated afterwards. Right? Just like that. Something that we thought was so delicious has now become a source of suffering to us. Right? We sit down, We take our Buddha posture, our Vairochana posture. Right? 20 minutes later, our back is aching. You know, when we first sat down, we were feeling so proud of ourselves. We're sitting just like a Buddha. We detected a little smile on Bodhidharma's face over here. Yeah. And all of a sudden, the posture has become a source of suffering to us. Right? Our loved ones, our significant others, our spouses, our children, our parents, right? Our loved ones. And sometimes, either mostly all of them, become sources of suffering to us. Right? And we become sources of suffering to them. Let's be fair. Right? In every skanda, in everything you look, that potential is there. And rather, again, not acknowledging that or being denial in it or always trying to repress it or, manipulate that fact is simply to acknowledge it, that is always there. And the third, and probably most important for us, is this whole issue of non-self. That there is no self, no I, in any of this. So these four insights, right, are really considered the insights that will liberate you. Because when you see clearly your inherent attachments and aversions, right, that are driven by our ignorance of the way reality really is, will begin to lessen. And as they lessen, there will be much less suffering in our life. If there's much less suffering in their life, there will be more happiness in our life, more equanimity in our life, more peace in our life. That is why it said profound realization of insight is the practice of samatha, or calm abiding. Right? See, many of us think, oh, I can only be calm if I, our breath is our anchor. Right? I always use my breath to calm me. If you have a respiratory problem, then what do you do? You want to be calmed by your insight. It doesn't mean these other practices aren't beneficial. They are. But Buddhas and Bodhisattvas and Masters are all liberated by their understanding of the nature of reality. As I've said many times, I think it's a good example. When the child understands that their dreams are not real, their scary dreams are not real, when the child understands that thing they do in their mind with the shadow that makes it think like there's a monster in the room, when they reach the point where they understand that those things are now true and real, they are liberated from their suffering. Right? They no longer need you to come in their room to calm them. Right? Many of us, we have developed ways to calm ourselves and to take care of ourselves when we are upset. And those are good ways. But there is a deeper way, that's all I'm saying to you. And that deeper way is understanding. When you understand what is real and unreal, when you understand your thoughts are not real, they're just thoughts. And what is a thought? No one knows. That's how insignificant they are. Right? Past thoughts are where? Gone. Future thoughts are where? Haven't come. Present thoughts, as soon as you try to look at them, you can't find them. Right? And yet they run our lives. We think this and we're off and running. We think that and our emotions are going haywire. We need to look deeply into thought. And what's the biggest thought that gets in our way? The thought of I, me, and mine. Just thoughts. just constructs. No basis in reality. I hope you don't believe me. Okay, I hope everybody here doesn't believe me, and for the rest of these 2 days in your meditation, you will prove me wrong by going inside your mind and finding your I and showing it to me. Okay? I hope you prove me wrong. See, here's Doug. If I said to Doug, Doug, before you came to retreat, where were you?
Home.
You were home. Can anybody verify that? Okay. So I could call Leah or call somebody, one of your kids, or so somebody could verify that Doug was at home, right? He didn't just appear out of nowhere at retreat. And if I said, Doug, after retreat, where are you going?
Home.
Okay. And so if I want, you know, if I wanted to see if it's true, I could what? Go to Doug's home and what? Hopefully he'd be there. Okay, all right. So there is somewhat of a reality, right, to Doug, at least in a certain sense, right? At least we know where he comes from and we know where he's going. And that can be verified, right? Does anybody know where their thoughts come from? Can you find them? Where? Where did, but where did the verbalization come from? Where does thoughts appear from?
Memory.
Thoughts appear from memory? What's a memory?
Experience I had last year.
Yeah, show me it. You just remember it. Okay? But even that thought that just appeared, where did it appear from? You watch your mind and you tell me if you can find where it appears from. You know what I'll tell you? You can't find it. It just appears out of nowhere. And where does it go? Where do thoughts go after it passes through your mind? Where does it go? You don't, what?
It's a residue of memory.
The residue of memory. Can you show me a residue of memory? No human being has ever seen a residue of memory, ever. We just talk this way. There's no such thing as a residue of memory. These are words. We endlessly spin words because we are scared of the truth. You know what the truth is? There's nothing. Things just appear and disappear. That's the truth. And that's the miracle. And that's the mystery. But we create a little conceptual world of past and future, you know, to what? Because we're afraid of facing the truth, my friend. The marvelous truth, the liberating truth, that there is nothing. No thing. And yet, miraculously, out of nowhere, things appear. That's the miracle. But we don't want to live in the miracle. We want to create a storyline. Past, present, future. Memory means what? I remember something that has already happened. But it's not real. It's just a memory. You know, in Zen, there are what's called dead words and live words. It's a very interesting answer. You know, a live word has life to it, has meaning to it. You know, forgive me my talking. In the relative sense, it can be. Thoughts that are liberating, thoughts that are helpful, thoughts that are beneficial. We would say short thoughts that shed light on things. No, we don't want to banish all thoughts. But we need to know what's real and not real, so we're not attached.
So bad thoughts are not real and good thoughts are real?
What?
So bad thoughts are not real and good thoughts are real?
No. From the point of view of what you're talking about, all of the same. From the point of truth, bad thoughts, good thoughts, all the same. They're just thoughts. How real is the thought? How real is the thought? thought you were just thinking a moment ago. Where is it? The thought you may be thinking right now. Take a look at it. Can you hold on to it? Can you find it? God, good thoughts, bad thoughts, high thoughts, low thoughts. That's just the truth. A truth that is verifiable by each and every one of us. Each and every one of us can verify this truth by looking deeply into your own experience. Again, this is not just intellectual gamesmanship. These teachings are present and tossed because it is by our attachment to thought, our belief in the permanence or reality or meaning of thought, that we get ourselves endlessly turned around. Oh, good. Then I'm doing a good job. Yeah. Inquire thoughts to what?
My very understanding is thought. That is thought.
Right. So what we're doing here in the Vipassana practice is to go beyond thought to have direct experience. Right? So it goes beyond something as fleeting and transient as a thought and becomes something directly experienced. This is the practice of Vipassana. Again, obviously thought thinking, thoughts that move us in the right direction, short, that give us some intellectual understanding, can often be helpful, right? A map can be helpful, right? No one is denying that. But on the other hand, after you got your map of Paris, after you bought your guidebook to Paris, I hope, B, when you get to Paris, you will not stay in your hotel room and just look through your travel book about Paris. I hope you will go out in there and do what? And see, walk, experience Paris. Right? That's all. So, all of the Dharma are the map and the guidebook. Right? To bring us to the point of what? Of directly experiencing. That's the important thing to understand. At a certain point, it says, the raft is not the shore. You've heard that. It's a very common expression. The raft is not the shore. So the teachings of the raft. Do not take the raft for the shore. The raft helps to get us to the shore. The shore is direct experience. Right, not even, and that's even worse.
I understand the importance of
appearance. Yes.
What I'm stuck with is for me, where I let me just talk for me.
Okay.
The insight that you mentioned, they are constructed thoughts, they are helpful thoughts, but they are thoughts.
And what is a thought?
Thought is as well as me and I that we are deconstructed.
Right.
But it is here.
Right.
What we are deconstructing is it does not exist. It exists.
It has a temporary existence, just like you do. Yeah, just like you do. You have a temporary existence. All phenomena is empty of any permanent composite. I mean, a permanent non-composite self. Yes. But the raft is not the shore. And thoughts are not the same as reality. They are thoughts about reality. Right? My thoughts about the flower, my understanding of the flower, my description of the flower is not the same thing as the flower. And it's important that we understand that. That's all. Right.
Actually, I just realized that a few months ago, when I came across the Buddhist theory or cognition theory, I suddenly realized everything that I think that I see that I understand is only the reflection in the mirror.
Yes.
And all this time I thought the reflection in the mirror is reality.
Right.
Well, I was quite shocked.
Good. That's a good shock.
Yeah, I was quite shocked. And it is also said that all our attributes are contaminated. All our attributes are contaminated.
Mm-hmm.
That includes our senses, our direct senses, not just our mental consciousness. Such as our eyes, our ears, our sight, our hearing, and touch, and all of that. So where I am right now, everything that I see is contaminated. It's not pure. So,
hold on.
I do not disagree with everything you say, but okay. I do not know how else to do it.
Okay. Do you see this?
Yes. Something very solid and real.
Those are words. Just look at this. Don't think anything. Don't think anything. Why contaminate this experience by saying anything about solid and real, about flowers or non-flowers? This is just this. When all is said and done at the end of the day, things are just as they are. And there's a way to understand that. Before there is any cognition, before there is any recognition, right? There is this. And this is pure experience, uncontaminated by any type of conceptualization. To say this is inside or outside, this is good or bad, this is empty or full, this is real or unreal, this is absolute or this is relative. It's just more the same. That's why it is said that this very land is the Buddha land. This very body is the body of Buddha. There's no separation, there's no duality. This is just this. I'm trying to do it. So we move on. Yes, yes.
That's one good one. We could see the gentleman about memory.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I had an insight when I was walking this morning that my whole retirement technique is genealogy.
Mm-hmm.
And 2 years, and just a day and a half now, I'm sort of blown away. And he said, our ancestral teachers who vowed to an
ancestor.
Mm-hmm. Reconstructed my senses when I was walking.
Good. Again, please understand, if we are not confused by our teachers, if we are not turned around by our teachers, then our teachers are not doing a good job. You know, it is good to question. I mean, a certain type of questioning that brings true understanding. This is our tradition. You know, what is mind? Who am I? What is real? What is not real? What is a thought? Where did they come from? These are all subjects of meditation and experience. These are good questions. Okay. All right. So in the practice, and today I want to move, again, tomorrow let's say I'm going to begin to look at Zen, some Hakuin Zenji, some Zen that goes about the same differently. And again, I actually I don't really know if this is in a book. I took this off the web, and then I found this text by Lama, by Nipon Rinpoche, and I can certainly find out where I downloaded it from, and so people want to access this text after their retreat. Again, you know, that thing with the body pure and impure, for those of you who've been disembodying your spouses and everything. Something making noise over there? Or am I doing it? Maybe Bodhidharma sending us messages. So again, you find the meditations specifically, you know, very kind of overarching on the disgusting nature of the human body, very much part of the monastic training, obviously having any desire for any for another human being in any kind of attractive or physical way is a no-no. So kind of meditating on the disgusting aspect of the body that one could possibly desire is often very much part of that tradition. Well, I think it is worth doing, so we take an unvarnished look at really what's going on in the body. It probably doesn't do all that much for your relationships to do it on a continual basis. But it's enough to look into the impermanent suffering, non-self composite nature without having to go overboard on the impurities, but understand why it is done. So again, after that investigation of the impurity, purity of the body, and after the investigation on the composite nature of the body, how it is made of parts, and also looking at all the skandhas and seeing how each of them is just made up of parts, now turn to, and again, the key phrase always is, once it's faded, do not artificially prolong it. Just rest and then start again. And so he says, but after that last one, but turn again to another investigation. And these are the ones on impermanence. Reflect deeply how these arrogates, which are impure and lack real essence, those are the last two, but perish from one moment to the next. All the civilizations and societies of the past met with only destruction in the end. And so will those of today and ages to come. The nature of the condition can inspire disenchantment. It's okay to be disenchanted when one realizes things are impermanent. Disenchantment does not mean a massive depression. Right? Disenchantment means what? No longer so enchanted. Right? You know, again, it doesn't mean we can't look out and appreciate the river and the tree. But, you know, enchantment, actually, I think it's an interesting word, isn't it? Enchantment is kind of like... isn't it like spells or something? You're enchanted, you know. Right, enchanted, but it's sort of almost like a spell or something. A witch has put enchanted someone, right, so they don't see clearly. They kind of become obsessed with something. So, you know, we have to be, you know, that's why words, especially words in relation to the Dharma, we have to look at what they're really meaning. The nature of the condition can inspire disenchantment. When we understand that the nature of the conditioned is impermanent, we will be less enchanted with it. But because impermanence is the nature of all phenomena, it's not like you can turn away wherever you go. Right? You will find impermanence. So one doesn't have to turn away from experiences or people or things, because it doesn't matter where you turn, even if you turn to the Dharma. Right? And if the Dharma becomes a thing, and if your relationship's in the Dharma, even if you went to a monastery, you know, you'd still what? There'd still be people, there'd still be things, there'll still be experience, all subject to impermanence. So we will become less enchanted with phenomena. And when we're less enchanted, it means we're less obsessed. We're less attached. We're less addicted. Death is certain for all living things. Suddenly it comes and without warning, reflect on how all that we experience in life is changing from one moment to the next. Okay? In the course of the past hour, listening to this talk, how many thoughts have you had? Can't even count. How many different responses? How many different feelings in your body? How many times have you changed your position, moved your head? You know, I mean, it's right. Uncountable. And that's what's going on everywhere, with everyone. Not just you, everyone. Thoughts, feelings, perceptions, changing one moment to the next. Right? Where have they gone? I can't find them. You know, where they go? I have no idea. Right? Endless thoughts in the past that moved in your life, gone. Yeah. And you have no idea. We have no idea what we're going to think the rest of the day. Does anybody know exactly what they're going to think the rest of the day? The thoughts are going to come into their mind? Right? It's just chaos. It's unpredictable. There's nothing to hold on to. Now that can make you very uptight. Or you can just relax in awareness. And using the tools of Dharma, lead a good life in that unknowing. Reflect on all the experience in life is changing from one moment to the next. In summary, to the best of your ability, consider all aspects of impermanence that characterize conditioned things. Reflect on each in turn with lucid thoughts. Recognize how the aggregates of those we desire are transient as lightning, evanescent like bubbles, fleeting like clouds in the sky. Until the momentum of this idea fades, focus your attention on nothing else. Okay? So, this is the third meditation we're doing in relationship to the five aggregates, impermanence. So when you set up your target, whether it's yourself, your five skandhas, whether it's somebody else, whether it's a flower, a candle, a tanka, a Buddha, a world, you know, meditate on the impermanence, impermanent nature of it. And then the next one is the suffering. And consider how each of these aggregates, which are momentary and consist of many aspects, their experiences we might describe as pain itself, and those that seem pleasant until they change, yet all provide the cause for future woes. And thus the skandhas are the basis of suffering. Reflect as well as much as you're able on all the misery there is in the world, all due to the imperfections of the skandhas. All right? It's the third suffering inherent in the skandhas. Again, the end of each reflection, each analysis is insight. You need to have the insight of impermanence, composite, suffering, and finally no self. When you have that insight, you rest. And you rest for as long as you rest, and then what will happen? The nonsense will start up again. That's just the way it is. When the nonsense starts up again, you hold it up, and you begin your investigation again. This continual investigation is what will liberate you. And again, we're learning how to do it on the mat, but this is something you can use in your daily life. As ego goes through its machinations, as emotional afflictions arise in your life, as impulses arise in your life that are taking you in directions you don't want to go, hopefully you'll have learned in these 4 days the rudiments of how to wield the sword of Manjushri Strength. To cut away elusive notions about reality. By doing that, you will bring greater mental calmness and clarity, peace to your life. At the end, investigate. So again, remain with the insiders for as long as you can. At the end, investigate these aggregates, which have many aspects and are impermanent, and whose suffering nature has now been shown. He keeps repeating, right? Just reminding us. Right? Every aggregate of all phenomena has many aspects, are impermanent, and all have somewhere in them the nature of suffering. And now look for what is called the I. And in Buddhism, this is the paramount. I mean, not that the others aren't important, but this is the paramount thing to look deeply at for human beings. Because it is our belief that there is a self operating here, an I, a me, a mine, and that is coloring our actions of body, speech, and mind. When you see that, like a waterfall, a shower of rain, or an empty house, they are devoid of any intrinsic self. Remain in this till this conviction fades. Okay. Interesting waterfall, okay? So, when we look at the mind, for that which we're calling the mind, and if you look deeply enough, you will see there's no such thing as a mind, but when we look in the direction that we think there's something called the mind, we will discover what? Thoughts arising and disappearing. Right? Now, there appears, we think, that these thoughts are linked, right? That there is a continuation that links all these thoughts, and this continuation that we think is linking all these thoughts is what? Me. My thoughts. I link them all together in something I call memory, and I call talk of what? My past. Right? I put together all my future thoughts and link them together, and I call them what? My future. But if you investigate it, you will see that there is gaps and spaces between these thoughts, each individually. You will not see. And, you know, the thread that links them does not exist. Again, I hope you don't believe me. And you disprove me. Okay, David? I'm counting on you. I'm counting on you, David, to disprove me. Okay? See if there is anything linking one thought to the next. It is because we do not understand that each thought arises independently that we link them together. You know, it is often said in the Dzogchen tradition, when the first thought arises, do not, like a chain link, a link of chains, do not link a second thought to it. We're the ones who do the linking. If you do not do that, they will not grow.
Hey, what about convention attack that when you go to the motorboat
25, suddenly you're attacking your teenage years with the children. Right. 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 I want you to find out what links them. Is there anything that links them? We're not saying that things don't arise and that one thing doesn't follow another, but if they were inextricably linked, how could he stop it? He can only stop it when he has understanding, goes, what am I doing? He stops it. He stops it only because they are not linked. Now, you didn't have to get out, some kind of instrument, did you? Right? I mean, if you've ever tried to undo a chain link fence, you need to get pliers and heavy duty instruments, right? Because they are truly linked, aren't they? Your thoughts are not linked. They appear linked. That's why, again, in the practice of Vipassana, and I want you to disprove me. I am hoping you will disprove me. But I will bet that you will see they are not linked. They appear to be linked, right? Because Jim just let one association lead to another. But even that, at some point, it would stop on its own. Right? I mean, even if you have a totally uncontrolled mind and you're just daydreaming, letting whatever comes into it, and, you're right, it'll go up here, and it'll go up there. And it'll go up over, you know, whatever, if you just let the mind go on its own. Why is that?
What's the mind's job?
That's the mind's job? I didn't say, what's the mind job, or that's the mind?
The mind is a thing you pay familiarity or pattern.
You mean the conceptual mind, the mind of the functioning mind.
Right.
Yeah.
Right, because everything is existing
in this
world that we live in.
Right,
You have to say, oh, mushroom, okay.
Yeah, there are quite, right. I mean, right. Yeah, but, well, I don't know if there was somebody who made it, like you made, you know, but somehow that's what it is. I think that's a better way. Somehow that is the way. Right. I mean, obviously, mind, if we look at mind, it has functioning qualities. It can link things together, it can recognize, it can label, it can make associations, it's capable of logic, and, I mean, all kinds of things. It's capable of insight. Right? But as D correctly pointed out, even those insights are empty of any permanence of it. Right? But yeah, so again, Buddhism, and obviously anybody who studied Buddhism understands that rationality, logic, et cetera, is used or overused in Buddhist teachings. But it's out of control. It's out of control. Right? To say that mind has functions is to say, yeah. But, you take out the hammer and the saw and the chisel, you know, when you're doing some woodwork. But you don't need to carry it around 24 hours a day and take it to bed with you, right?
From what you, everything that you say, it seems that you're not balancing yourself. You can't get to your thoughts, it's not all in. You want to balance the illusion thought that you have no control of, you usually call the shadow.
Well, again, even the chatter is, you know, what we really want to banish are those thoughts that produce suffering. And those, I mean, the Buddha's, again, you know, yogis, and, you know, there are certain kinds of realizations, but for people like us, what we really want to banish, or not even banish, we really want to understand deeply, and then that way they become banished because they don't respond, are those delusive thoughts that lead us in directions that produce suffering. I mean, the Buddha always said, I'm only here to teach the end of suffering. You know, I'm not here for any other purpose.
And as a form of meditation, when we are engaging in mindfulness meditation, or Kamabhati meditation, we are not engaging in managing thoughts, but we are engaging in stabilizing our mind so that we can place our thoughts exactly where we want it.
Good. I don't know whether you're making a statement or asking a question.
Is that it? What we're doing when we are engaging in mindfulness.
Again, traditionally in this tradition, right, the practices of mindfulness and the practices of single point of concentration or calming the mind. Traditionally, again, the Buddhist meditative tradition was developed by serious meditators. Right? They were not, it really, that tradition was not developed by lay people. It was really developed by yogis. Right? It was people who were seriously meditating. And so the stages of mindfulness, concentration, samadhi, insight were seen as kind of the movement of the mind toward realization. Right? And mindfulness and samadhi, or the capacity of having single point of concentration, was so that when we got to the stage of investigating the nature of phenomena of the mind was just laser-like. It could just, you know, go right forward and hold that concentration, hold that insight, and just keep boring away until it got to the essence of things, right? So when you got to the stage of insight, your mind still wasn't all over the place. You know, you meditate on permanence for 2 minutes, and then you're thinking about lunch, and then you're, right? It's very hard to get realization without that kind of stabilization. But my experience these days, because, you know that most of us at least are not practicing, in three-year retreats and things like that, the teaching, at least for my teachers, is there has to be a certain level of mindfulness and a certain level of stability and clarity, as opposed to the absolute level that you often get in the text, again, which were texts developed for people who were like yogis, you know, practicing the yogic path. So let me continue. You guys are tough today. See, I should have never taken a question. Go on. It's just like opening that door.
Well, what I'd like, I guess, what I'm looking for is the clarification of the meditation.
Yeah.
I think it's more nebulous than the rest.
Yeah.
Call it consciousness.
It's consciousness of. All right. So the eye is conscious of objects. The ears are conscious of sound. The nose is conscious of smell. The mouth is conscious of touch. Of taste, the body is conscious of sensation, touch, and the mind is conscious of thoughts, feelings, perception. So consciousness is that fifth skandha. Okay.
And there's a construction. What is the deconstruction?
What?
The deconstruction in that. I mean, I mixed it up with perception in it.
Yeah.
Perceiver and
right. But again, please understand that actually the way the mind works, it's a you know, you break it into, so you say, you break the mind into these four aspects, as if they're sequential, right? First there's, the bare recognition of an object. Almost immediately there is an attraction or an aversion or just a neutral response. Then there's a labeling or perception. And then all the mental formations and impulses and history that are in our subconscious, through our consciousness also. But it all happens very simultaneously, but what links it all, of course, is that we are conscious of something. Right. And that conscious of something, again, is dependent on all these other things. Right? And it is also fickle. Right? I am now conscious of Doug. Right? But now I am no longer conscious of Doug. Right? I am conscious of this beautiful flower in front of me, but now I am not conscious of this beautiful flower. I am conscious of the beautiful tree outside, but now I am not conscious of the tree. I am conscious of the sound of the air conditioning. So even our consciousness is flickering. Right? It is not stable. It is not, right? And it is out of control, which is not a bad thing. I mean, our minds are out of control. It's not a bad thing if we don't, the horse is wild, untrained, just don't get on it. Right? If you don't get on the horse, there's no problem. It can run around all it wants. It can buck and, don't get on it. The trouble is, we're always getting on it. We just can't resist. If we practice inside practice, we will understand this is a wild horse just moving around to its own nature. Don't get on it. You can appreciate a wild horse, right? Can't you? In the great perfection tradition, thoughts are called the magical display of our true nature. The magical display. These minds are incredible. Creative, right? Just endlessly throwing up things. experience perceptions. But you cannot see the magical display of your mind, you know, if you're being knocked around by it. Right? If one is on the land and looking out at the North Atlantic in a storm, the sea is, waves are big, things are blowing. If one is in one's little warm house with the fire going, looking out the window, it can be quite wonderful, can it? To absorb nature. Right? Or in Florida, it could be wild up to a certain point to observe the fury, so-called, of nature in a hurricane. Pretty incredible energy, right? If one is safe, be observing. Right? But coming back to our North Atlantic storm, if you were out there in a sailboat, it would be a very different experience, wouldn't it? One would not at that point probably be appreciating the power of nature, right? If one was out in the hurricane, without any shelter, and the winds were 160 miles an hour and blowing in all directions and things were blowing, one would not be able to appreciate the power of nature. Right? But when one is at a place where one can observe safely, one can appreciate even the power of nature, can't we? Even destructive power. This is the practice. There are storms that pass through our minds, aren't there, from time to time? Everybody know those storms that pass through? Yeah. But if you get swept by those storms, danger, destruction, suffering. Right? But if you have the capacity just to see them for what they are, and let them pass through, they don't have any power to affect you, to affect your behavior, even to affect your mind. They just pass through and they leave no trace if you don't act on them. With deep insight, one can begin to do that. So like a waterfall, again, the example of, as I was saying about thoughts, a waterfall, you look at a waterfall and you see what? Water falling, it looks like something solid. Right? But if you really could examine it really closely, you would see what? They're just millions and millions of drops, individual drops that are falling. But it appears like it's a solid sheet of water. Right? So in the same way, it appears that the endless unfolding of thoughts, like it's a thing, like a waterfall. But if you look closely, you will see they're just all individual thoughts that are appearing and disappearing. They are devoid of any intrinsic self. Remain until this conviction fades. When it does disappear, then once again investigate in the stages as have been shown. And now, having giving us the four major ways to look at each of the five skandhas, Mikram Rinpoche then goes, sometimes contemplate in no particular sequence or else investigate a variety of things. Practice investigating these points again and again, sometimes considering another's aggregates, sometimes looking at your own, and at times analyzing all that is conditioned, and at times analyzing all that is conditioned. So he's saying, in the beginning, kind of just to get, as beginners, kind of do it the way he said, right? With the five skandhas, with the object of attachment oneself or somebody you're attached to, and very sequentially, look at the composite nature of that skandha, the suffering nature of the skandha, the impermanent nature of the skandha, and the non-self nature of that skandha, right? But then he said, after that, you can begin to mix it up a little bit. You can create your own sequence. Sometimes you can look here, sometimes you can there. Sometimes you can just you know, take whatever object's in front of you, or you know, if you're eating something, right? Investigate the nature of taste. You can investigate the nature of each of your senses as an experience. What's really going on here? And then he says, and turn this wheel of analysis again and again. This is clear. If we want results, we have to turn it again and again. We have to be, when we are practicing this body of practices and teaching, that are called vipassana, or you know, the higher way to see, the higher view, the deeper view. It has to go over and over again. The more you analyze, the more your certainty will grow. We are incredibly wedded at this point to our delusive way of seeing things, right? As we said before. We see the impermanent as permanent. We see that which is really intrinsically a cause of suffering, we think it's a cause of happiness. We think things are solid when really they're made of composite parts, and we believe there's a self-existent I, me, mine, you know, that comes from that I within myself and everyone else. Right? I mean, you know, we've been doing it for a long time. So the only way we can, you know, it's sort of like, again, it's sort of like you want to plant some seeds in this field. You want to plant some beautiful plants in this field, but it is hard. It has not been worked in this way, ever. So you're going to have to spend some time turning over the soil, getting out there with a pick and a shovel and turn over. It's like that. So the mind begins to loosen up. So the attachments begin to soften. So the misperceptions get corrected. Again and again. The more you do that, the more your certainty will grow. Apply, therefore, a clear mind of intelligence to all kinds of observations just like these. And like wildfire spreading across a grassy plain, practice continually without interruption. Again, Mipham Rinpoche, he, again, I would imagine, I could be making this up, but I would imagine that his audience for this were people who were on retreats, monks, nuns, laymen, lay people, but primarily who were in retreat. I mean, in the Tibetan tradition, when one went into the practice at this level, people traditionally did it in retreat. If you have the opportunity to do it in retreat, wonderful. But for most of us, it's just going to have to be ongoing application and remembering these practices in our daily life. Say to yourself, in the past, I would always get caught in my mistaken ideas and attitudes. This led to all kinds of useless speculation. But now I will only consider this instead. This is this wheel of investigation. Okay. So I read that again so we can all remember that one. So we say to ourselves, in the past, I would always get caught in my mistaken ideas and attitudes, which led to all kinds of useless speculation. But now I will only consider this. Which means what? Whatever is arising, whatever phenomena we're dealing with, we see, we are looking, we would say, to see its impermanent nature, right, before. So that's what we're doing. We're not endlessly speculating in all directions. We're very clear that we are analyzing phenomena. Phenomena means everything, including thoughts, feelings, perceptions, etc., or any concepts of I or self, or thoughts, or whatever it is, or objects, whatever it is, or tastes, or you know, seeing, or sounds, in this way. To put it another way, we are continually deconstructing reality. Again, it is said, you know, in Shantideva, I remember in his, one of his early verses, in the Wisdom chapter, he said, this way of looking is not the way of looking of ordinary people. It is the way that a yogi looks. Ordinary people just see what? Appearances. Practitioners look under appearances to see what's really going on. Is that clear? That's what we're doing. Things are not as they appear. And again, you know, a lot of this is science, right? I mean, you know, in their day they didn't know about physics and molecules and atoms and subatomic particles and, right? And quarks. You know, they didn't know about this, but they did understand, you know, they were very close. And actually I forget what they called them, but in the Abhidhamma, they actually had a sense of atoms or something, or molecules, that there was, and they could only have seen it in their meditation. They were able to have such razor-like minds that they could see when they looked in their own phenomena of their own mind, that as when they began to break things down, they postulated some kind of molecular particles or something. I forget what they were called now. To everything. But again, science tells us that nothing is solid. Right? I mean, this appears solid, right? We would say this is solid. But somebody would say, no, there's more energy moving around, particles. That's what it is. So even science will tell us that things are not as they appear to our senses. In the past, I would always get caught in my mistaken ideas and attitudes, which led to all kinds of useless speculation. I would say, a useless speculation, etc. Well, my mistaken ideas and attitudes led to all kinds of useless speculation, etc. Okay, there are many other things that have led to besides the useless speculation. But now I will only consider this instead. If you find yourself getting tired, yet notice that the afflictions still do not arise, even without applying the antidote, then rest in equanimity to refresh your mind. After a while, once your tiredness is no more, repeat the investigation just like before, at all times being mindful and aware of the insight the investigation brings. If at times you slip into forgetfulness and the afflictions have occasion to arise, then take up this investigation once more, like reaching for a weapon when enemies appear. Just as light will banish darkness, it is almost needless to say a precise investigation such as this, even if only practiced a little, will do great harm to the kleshas. These are the afflictive emotions. However much one understands the flaws of this conditioned samsaric world, one will also understand the unconditioned, nirvana's supreme and refreshing peace. Is that clear?
This is one simple question.
Yes.
It's impermanent.
Well, it's sort of a variation on self. The first one is everything is made up of parts. Everything is a composite. All phenomena composite. I mean, which is a sort of saying self, but the self is the big one because it's what human beings impute to their parts. And because it is because it is such a significant, the central delusion that we work under as human beings, I don't know if, in the world of citrus dharma, whether they have to deal with those things. They just deal with their, their sections. So it's like that. So those are the four. Let me just read one more section. The second section is called the measure of progress. Eventually, through familiarity with this practice, you will naturally appreciate how everything included within the five skandhas and the unconditioned is manifold, impermanent, painful, and devoid of self. Even without deliberate effort, the whole of your experience will seem magical and insubstantial, and you will overcome the kleshas or afflictive emotions. Did you hear that? This is what Rinpoche is saying to us. He says, as we become more familiar with these practices, and how we naturally will appreciate that within the five skandhas, everything is manifold, which means, you know, multiple parts, impermanent, painful, and devoid of self. That will be our natural way we look at things. We will no longer misperceive. We will no longer be ambushed. We will no longer be surprised. We will have a clear view of the nature of phenomena. And then, without deliberate effort, the whole of your experience will seem magical and insubstantial, and you will overcome afflictive emotions. Again, it's sort of what I said before. You know, at this point, our experience is tightly tied and wound up with these false views. So our life is very constricted and seems substantial and often heavy, tight, narrow, right? Through this practice, we will be unburdened of our delusive constructs, which will mean we will be unburdened of our delusive afflictive emotions, and everything will be lighter. Right? Now we think everything is solid, including our bodies, including ourselves. So we react very strongly and heavily to things as they arise. But when we see clearly the nature of phenomena, we can let things be. Things can arise in understanding and awareness. It's an open field. And so what he's saying, the whole of your experience will seem magical. When you have no thoughts of what you think is going on, and you're just appreciative of what is going on as it occurs, things appear quite magical, the way life unfolds. But we think, we know exactly what's going on. The truth is, we don't have a clue. Does anybody know what their next thought is going to be? I mean, I keep saying that because it's so obvious. We don't have a clue. Right? Do we? Doug thinks he's going home. He may make it or not. And if I say, Doug, do you know actually the experience you're going to have when you come home? Can you, with 100% accuracy, say exactly what your experience is? 100%. Only because what? Only because what? Because you are contaminating that future with some kind of thought of what happened in the past. No, that was it. I'm happy you said that. But the truth is, you don't have the slightest idea what that experience is going to be as an experience. But that's wonderful. Life becomes very magical anyway, very open, very spontaneous, very natural. We're always surprised, in a good way, by the way life unfolds. You don't need a past or a future to enjoy life and to respond appropriately to the situation as they arise. We think we do. We think we need a whole template, right? You know, we need a workbook. But we need understanding, insight, open-heartedness, compassion. You know, that's all we need. And the truth is, you already have a lot of that. You do have a natural wisdom. Yes?
Is the assumption that when you have a thought, and then you discuss it, that thought will not continue to
realize? No, the thought may realize. Again, we don't have control over that. But again, the problem is not that thoughts arise. Thoughts is that when they arise, we do not see them as just just that, whatever it is, and that let be, it will just disappear. It will just arrive. That is its nature. That's what we talk about, you know, that's what I'm saying. Don't take my word for it, observe your own thoughts. That's what I mean. I'm really saying, you know, I'm pointing you in a direction, but I want you all to be scientists and go, you know, is this my own experience? Right. That thought, seen clearly, there is really nothing linking them, other than what Jim described yesterday. He got attracted by that boat, right? And all of a sudden a thought arose in his mind about, oh, we had a boat like that. And before he knew it, they were all being chained together. You know? And again, eventually that chain would have run out, right? And then another one would start up. But again, if the mind is empty and unattached, that thought, you know, you just see the boat, and that's it. Right? Now again, it doesn't mean that if in the moment, you know, somebody might say, well, that was a nice thing to remember, what's her name? Right? Shelley. Thank you. Somebody else is remembering. See, you're just spreading your poison everywhere. I mean, again, you know, there's no, there's no great harm that was done. Right? The only harm is if that is what's always happening. Right? Left to its own devices, the mind will chain itself in all kinds of ways that are productive of suffering, of difficulty, of, you know, all kinds of stuff, right? Of worry, of fear, of anger, of resentment, of concern, you know what I mean? Of list making, of responsibility. You know, I mean, the mind is by itself. You know, you'll never leave work. Right? You know, you get yourself so geared up at work with all the things you got to do, you know what I mean? And then it just continues on. Right? Because we haven't developed the capacity to see each thought as a discrete entity. Eventually, through familiarity with this practice, you will naturally appreciate everything included within the five skandhas and the unconditioned, manifold, impermanent, painful, and devoid of self, the four things, right? Even without deliberate effort, the whole of your experience will seem magical and insubstantial, and you will overcome the kleshas, afflictive emotions. When it is free from the waves of the afflictive emotions, the ocean of your mind is made serene and calm. This is conducive to gaining mental self-control. So it's a little reversal here. Usually the samatha, the calming, comes first. But here he's saying, through the practice of wielding the analytical wheel of investigation and meditation, that in itself will produce a serene and calm mind through which one reaches a samadhi of calm abiding. If you can then look into the very identity of the mind in one point to concentration, that is the extraordinary insight of vipassana. So we need to practice. It would be wonderful that just hearing these words, these great teachings of Nipam Rinpoche, we were all liberated, right? And the kleshas all dissolved, all our mental confusion dissolved, and we were free. But unfortunately, we have to practice. We are like children. We don't like to practice. Right? Anybody remember having to practice an instrument when they were in grade school? Most of us did not like to practice. Right? Many of us are still like that. Right? Practice is what? Boring. Practice is repetitive. And since many of us are, you know, we like to succeed, right? We like to be confident. We're high achievers, right? We don't like to practice something which we're continually screwing up, right? So, you know, that is why it is often, you know, we don't like to practice. You know, if we could sit down and get it right away and it sounded beautiful, we'd love to practice. But, you know, we don't. So, you know, that's why, you know, the whole process of practice and all the obstacles that we create are all grist for the mill. Keep looking. Okay? Please acknowledge that. But there's no other way. And again, I think once you get it, and once you begin to use it and begin to experience your capacity for deconstructing the event, so it doesn't balloon out of control, so it doesn't lead to emotional affliction, so it doesn't lead to acting out, so it doesn't lead to wrong speech, you know, et cetera, right? I think you'll get excited by the power of this practice. It's really quite simple. But you want to be able to catch it early. But even if you can't catch it early, and if you catch it after it all blows up, you can still put it up on the board and deconstruct it. So maybe next time you can catch it better. Is that clear? You know, don't fault yourself. Just do the best you can. So what I'm suggesting, and for those people who are reading guided meditation later, is that we begin the investigation of the mind. Yesterday we focused a lot on the body. Again, I think it's important because if you think of human beings, basically we identify ourselves with what? Our body, our mind, and the name that holds it together. Right? So most of us would say, you know, this is Fred, you know, who are you, Fred? Well, you know, this is my body, and this is my mind. Put them two together, put the label Fred on it, and you got Fred, right? And I would say most of the people here think the same thing, right? Doug over there goes, yeah, my name's Doug, I got a body and a mind, and I call it Doug, right? Jim's got one over there, everybody else has got the same thing going. So we want to deconstruct all that. Right. We spent yesterday deconstructing the body. We want to deconstruct the mind in the way that is suggested tomorrow. But tomorrow we'll see a different way of looking at the mind. And in the mind, we're talking about what? Thoughts? What? Yeah, but mostly, yeah. But again, I think at the essence, it's thoughts. Past thoughts, present thoughts, future thoughts. But also, you know, what is mind? Yesterday we looked for the body and we found just lots of parts and nothing to be called the body. I would hope that everyone would look at their mind. Most people think they have a mind. I'm going to make a radical statement. You don't have a mind. Somebody, please disprove me. Somebody finds their mind, please bring it here. Okay? I'd love to see one. I've been looking for 40 years. I still can't find my mind. But maybe I'm just slow-witted or something. Yes?
Yes, it's helpful that you leave the deconstruction of the ego of
the self. Definitely. That's what we're looking at too today. That was the one that was introduced today. That phenomena, and in this case we're talking about the phenomena of a human being in their body and mind, no such thing as a self that is permanent, self-existent, etc., can be found. Please disprove me. Again, in this practice, especially the practice of looking for the self or looking for the mind, if you do it correctly, you will, at the end of your investigation, you will feel spacious and open and relatively unencumbered. So that is why the instruction is, at that point, rest in that experience. And hold it as long as you can. And then after a certain amount of time, he or she will start up again. And then you just begin the turning the wheel of analysis again. So, once again, it's almost 12:30. So please enjoy your practice. This is a very, we're now really at the heart of Buddhist meditative tradition. Insight, understanding, the nature of phenomena, reality, the mind. It is not, you know, the profundity of these practice and teachings manifests over time, and there are levels and depths of levels, but a rudimentary appreciation of insight is in the reach of everyone here, if you just follow these instructions.